Graham Easton, who marks 50 years since the first successful organ transplant, with a look back through the BBC's radio and television archives in tonight's Archive Hour.
Hello?
This is Dr. Rowe at the Western Infirmary in Glasgow here. You've probably guessed why I'm phoning you at this time on a Saturday night.
You're joking.
Yep, we've got a kidney for you.
In the name of God.
You could get one tomorrow, you could get one in 10 years' time. You don't know. I think the thing you have to try and do is to almost put it to the back of your mind, if you like, and try and just get on with your life. I mean, in the first 2 years when I was on dialysis, I was basically just sitting there waiting for one, you know, because they told me when I first started that I should get one within 2 years. You know, I mean, I assume now that, well, I know I'll get one eventually, but, you know, when, you don't know. So you sort of work on the principle that you won't get one.
These two clamps, I've actually put them on the kidney artery and vein, and now I can let the blood into the kidney. And there you are. You have a kidney which has come alive again. That's a beautiful kidney.
When I was a medical student looking after a youngster about my age who was dying of kidney disease, and I was told to try and make him comfortable for the last 2 weeks of his life, and I asked the consulting physician if he couldn't have a graft of a kidney, and I was told no. And I then asked, why not? And then I was told, because it can't be done. This struck me as odd, because I knew from a surgical point of view, the kidney is a smallish organ you can hold in your hand. It has an artery and a vein and a drainage tube for the urine. And why shouldn't it be possible to join these things together? And of course it is. But what I didn't know at that time, and I'm still learning about, is the body's tendency to reject a graft, the immune reaction, and that has been my main work over the last 40 years, still not complete.
That was Sir Roy Khan, former professor of surgery at Cambridge University, one of the pioneers of transplantation. Work in progress, maybe, but we've come a very long way since almost 50 years ago to this day, when a team of doctors in the United States performed the first successful kidney transplant from one living human to another. Now we can transplant virtually any organ you can think of: heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, bowel, even hands, and it's easy to take it all for granted. But the transplant story is no fairy tale. Alongside the twin triumphs of the surgery itself and tricking the immune system into accepting a body part from someone else, there's been despair, public outcry, and personal tragedy. This Archive Hour traces the ups and downs of 5 decades of organ transplantation and how the doctors and the patients have steered us to where we are today. British surgeon Peter Butler is even thinking about transplanting a face.
That is taking a face from a organ donor and transplanting it onto a patient with a severe facial deformity and hooking it up with its own blood supply with microvascular surgical techniques, which are techniques as plastic surgeons we use quite regularly already.
People have been trying to transplant body parts for centuries, from crude leg transplants in ancient Rome to transplanting monkey testicles to boost virility in the 1920s. But until recently, nearly all of them ended in disaster, evidence of the body's overwhelming urge to reject tissue that it doesn't recognise as its own. By the 1950s, surgeons had the microsurgical know-how for transplanting organs, and anaesthetics and antibiotics had greatly improved their operative success. But they were still baffled as to why transplanted tissue always seemed to wither and decay. The first real breakthrough came during the Second World War. The appalling difficulties surgeons faced when trying to repair the skin of badly burned patients led the young Oxford University scientist Peter Medawar, a handsome man and a gifted zoologist, to make a crucial discovery about rejection. Speaking in 1974, Medawar recalls the situation leading to his discovery.
By the time war broke out, the blood transfusion services were operating well and new antibiotics had come in. And as a result of that, the people who suffered these dreadful burns survived. And then the problem was, having lost all that big area of skin, what on earth could one do with them? The obvious thing to do then would be to get skin from somebody else and use that, from a relation or from a voluntary donor. And for purposes like this, voluntary donors are not slow to come forward. But the great obstacle here was simply that skin transplanted from one person to another does not survive. It sticks on at first and looks fine, but it will not survive. It's eventually sloughed off as a result of an immunological rejection process.
Having identified the immune system as the driving force behind rejection, he then went on to demonstrate how rejection of foreign tissue can be overcome in animals. Medawar received the Nobel Prize in 1960 for his groundbreaking work. But back then, even he didn't believe that his work would be much use in solving the problems of human transplants. Professor Leslie Brent collaborated with Medawar in the early 1950s.
Now, up to then, the whole thing was a fascinating biological problem, but it wasn't really thought about as a practical way of inducing tolerance in patients. In fact, after a lecture in Cambridge, this must have been in 1960 probably, a medical student got up and asked Peter the question, did he think that his Torrance work had any clinical significance or application? And he said, absolutely none.
But it wasn't long before surgeons themselves realised how Medawar's work could help their patients. While they had no practical way of preventing the human immune system from rejecting an implanted organ, with so many patients dying of kidney disease, they simply refused to accept Medawar's immune barrier. In the 1950s, one team of researchers and physicians at a small hospital in Boston, the Peter Bent Brigham, decided to have a go. The Brigham had a big advantage over the others, a machine that could clean the blood of patients with kidney failure, keeping them reasonably fit while waiting for a new kidney. Few other centres were so lucky. The artificial kidney hadn't crossed the Atlantic yet. So for British patients like Peter Rado, then aged 15, the prospects were bleak.
I was very young and nobody knew what was wrong with me for quite a long time. And then they discovered it was renal failure in a hospital in Reading and gave me 4 days to live. And my mother, being my mother, wouldn't take no for an answer and rang up a friend of the family who knew an awful lot about kidneys, because he was Hans Krebs, who was the Krebs cycle biochemistry of the kidney man. I said, Hans, you know something about kidneys, do something. And he sent me, suggested I got sent to a consultant in London who was knew a lot about kidneys. And they sent me to St Thomas's Hospital, where effectively I was told there wasn't anything they could do. They put me on antibiotics, which... luckily, the kidney started up again and started working at about 50%. And nobody quite knows why. And I was then taking antibiotics for, 6 or 7 years.
The Boston team's artificial kidney was based on Wilhelm Kolff's original drum dialyzer. As a young doctor working in Nazi-occupied Holland, Kolff devised the machine to remove toxins like urea from the blood, a cellophane-wrapped drum which rotated through a bath of fluid. Kolff in 1987.
This is a dialyzing membrane. It looks like a ribbon, but actually it's a tube. And when the blood is inside the tube, small molecules go through the membranes of the tube and are washed away by the dialyzing fluid. This is called dialysis, okay? And at the same time, electrolytes such as sodium, potassium, they go both in and out. So an equilibrium is formed between the electrolytes of the patient and the electrolytes of the dialyzing fluid.
In a matter of hours, it could remove vast quantities of toxic waste and restore the patient to health. But until the early 1960s, connecting the patient was a major procedure.
Now going to use these cannulae that we've got here, take the blood off from the leg, through the machine, and put it back into this one.
All this could only be done a few times before the patient ran out of blood vessels. If by then the patient's kidneys hadn't recovered by themselves, they were sent home to die. So, without any real alternative, the Brigham team began transplanting kidneys. They started by leaving both the patient's own kidneys in place and transplanting the donor kidney into the thigh so they could remove it easily if something went wrong. The donated organ usually came from a cadaver and the urine drained out through a tube. Most of these patients died from rejection, but the surgeon Joseph Murray was surprised to find that a few survived for much longer than he'd expected. Here he is in 1987.
The most dramatic was a young doctor that came up from Peru, I believe, certainly from South America, who had a thigh transplant. which functioned for 5.5 months very well. And we had a plastic bag like you have for colostomies, collecting the urine, because the ureter came right out the thigh. And he wore this bag, and I remember he used to take the subway downtown with his plastic bag tacked onto his thigh. That kidney was finally rejected at about just under 6 months. But it was a tremendously stimulating experience, because it somehow seemed that this could work.
Having refined his surgical technique for transplanting kidneys, Murray reasoned that the ideal transplant operation would be between identical twins. He thought that since they share the same genetic makeup and immune systems, there shouldn't be a problem with rejection. Roy Kahn.
He'd worked with plastic surgeons who had done skin grafts between identical twins, showed that they worked, and then he did the experiment, which was the autograft of kidney in dogs, and some of those dogs survived for years. So he had confidence that if there was a patient, that this would work.
In 1954, Richard Herrick came to the Brigham, dying of renal disease, just the patient Joseph Murray had been waiting for. Richard had an identical twin brother called Ronald, with two healthy kidneys, one of which he could spare. Humans can survive quite happily on just one healthy kidney. So with identical immune systems, and therefore no immunological barrier to defeat them, the twins seemed the perfect candidates for the first kidney transplant using a living donor. The crucial operation was set for the 23rd of December 1954, 50 years ago this week.
Within 10 seconds, urine began to pour out the ureter. The patient had a lot of extra fluid on board, so he was urinating copiously all over the field, coming down onto the floor. We had to get the nurses to mop it up until we connected the ureter and put it into the bladder. Of course, now that's commonplace. We expect kidneys to function. But this was a first, and it was very exciting.
Transplantation proceeded without event.
Now, how does it feel to have three kidneys? Any different?
No, it feels no different at all.
To take out a normal kidney from a normal healthy person for the benefit of somebody else was totally unheard of. And there was no point in going to a library, because you knew that nobody ever had done it in the world.
Within weeks, the Herrick twins walked out of hospital the picture of health. Murray had shown that in identical twins at least, it was possible to remove a kidney, keep it cool without damaging it, and to transplant it surgically so that it worked perfectly. It was a huge morale boost for others in the field. As the Brigham Hospital became famous, a steady stream of identical twins trickled in from around the world. They were exciting times. René Fox is a medical sociologist who was working at Peter Bent Brigham during the pioneering 1950s.
This was an era when the first successful mitral valve surgery was being done. This was an era in which work was going forward on the artificial kidney machine. It was a very effervescent time. It was a very exciting time. But the clinical investigators involved in these kinds of undertakings, including renal transplantation, were not unaware of some of the deeper ethical questions. And certainly, the live kidney transplantation, for example, raises the specter for physicians of the most serious kind of moral problem imaginable, even for the persons who believe in doing everything they possibly can to further organ transplantation.
The Hippocratic Oath puts great emphasis on doing no harm, but here were doctors removing a kidney from a healthy donor, putting their life at risk for what was essentially still an experimental procedure. The public had their concerns, and there was still a huge scientific frustration. How could a kidney be transplanted between patients who weren't identical twins, given Medawar's immune barrier? If they could breach this somehow, perhaps kidneys from unrelated donors could be used, perhaps even from cadavers. A clue came from radiotherapy for cancers, which, as well as shrinking tumours, was known to have the side effect of suppressing the patient's immune system. Perhaps if patients were exposed to a non-fatal dose of radiation, for example, they might then accept a kidney transplant.
A sublethal dose of radiation was administered to the potential recipient, which means, as a matter of fact, that you almost kill the patient, and then you rescue the patient from that almost fatal state. But I knew that the only way, short of having a donor who was genetically identical to the recipient, the only way that the team had available to it of trying to handle the inexorable rejection-reaction phenomenon was to use total body irradiation.
I tried X-radiation in experimental transplants and found that it was just too blunt a tool. And I thought that we must look somewhere else. And drugs was the obvious place to look because there are a number of drugs which have some effects which are similar to X-radiation.
Roy Kahn was appointed as a registrar. I made arrangements for him to do the animal work, which was sufficiently impressive for us to start using the results of it in clinical cases, the first one in November 1959.
The surgeon John Hopewell was appointed to set up a renal unit at the Royal Free Hospital in London in the mid-1950s. He and Roy Kahn were keen to try out new drugs to suppress the immune system's natural aggression towards an alien kidney.
The first agent that was used to prevent the rejection of the kidney was a rather complicated drug called 6-mercaptopurine. That's its chemical name. And it had been shown by two former scientists called Schwartz and Damischek to be effective in helping skin grafts to be accepted in mice. And it was Roy Kahn's burning ambition to demonstrate whether this was equally effective with kidney grafts, first of all in the dog and then in man.
Roy Kahn did have some success in dogs, and he published his promising results in a paper in The Lancet in 1960. Kahn had opened the door to immunosuppression using drugs. Peter Medawar then noticed Kahn's paper and put him in touch with Joseph Murray in Boston, who was still doing his identical twin transplants. Kahn flew out to the States full of optimism, only to find that Murray had plans for him to work on irradiation.
I was absolutely heartbroken at this because I said, Dr. Murray, I've come all this way to get away from irradiation and to work with drugs. And then it suddenly clicked that he had seen this little paper in The Lancet, and he said, oh, well, yes, he said, well, you can start with that, and if it doesn't work, you can join the irradiation group. So at that time, I don't think he was full of anticipation of success. But by the time he came back from holiday, there were animals who were doing well with kidney grafts, and he was very impressed and gave me the go-ahead and the resources to develop that work with drugs.
Working together in Boston, Roy Kahn and Joseph Murray began to have greater and greater success with dogs. Their drugs were clearly suppressing the immune system from rejecting the donated kidney. Kahn had the benefit of another drug up his sleeve. It was called azathioprine. Kahn continued his work on dogs, on one occasion using a rather creative technique to persuade his hospital colleagues of the value of this new drug. One of his kidney transplant patients, called Lollipop, showed no signs of rejection after 6 months. A case was presented at a hospital grand round.
She was presented by the surgical resident as if she was a patient. He said this young adult, female, had a kidney transplant 6 months ago and was treated with the drug azathioprine, and the patient is doing very well. And he said, I think we'll now ask the patient to come in. And he opened the door, and I called Lollipop, and she bounced in and licked the knees and fingers of all the important professors in the front row. They were somewhat astounded, and I think it had a big effect on persuading them to use this treatment in patients not a long time after.
Murray felt the time was right to see if these immune-suppressing drugs would work in humans by transplanting a kidney between non-related donor and recipient. If it worked, it would be the first successful attempt to cross the immune barrier. But it was risky.
We only used kidneys, which would otherwise be thrown away. And we only used recipients who would otherwise die. And the first two patients we transplanted died with functioning kidneys, but they died of toxicity of the drug. And the third patient we used, with about a quarter of the expected dose, the third patient survived with a cadaveric transplant. And he survived for over 1 year. We published him in the New England Journal of Medicine in June of 1963. And that was the key article that started transplantation on a worldwide basis.
And of course, it was when azathioprine was used together with cortisone that we started getting good results in kidney grafts in men, and that was really the beginning of therapeutic kidney grafting apart from identical twins.
This particular surgeon has done a great deal of pioneering work in the search for a method of overcoming this immunological barrier which the human body sets up against foreign tissue and which causes it to reject a kidney, for example, donated by a person other than an identical twin of the patient.
On Christmas Day, Mrs. Eve Martin saw her 20-year-old daughter, Yvonne, for the first time since the double operation in which she donated one of her kidneys.
But the day I took her up there, they told me that there wasn't much hope for her, and she was due for a kidney transplant, but when it would come up, the doctors and surgeons didn't know. I said, well, if it's a kidney you want, you can have one of mine. When I saw Yvonne for the first time after the operation to speak to, I said to her, Yvonne, it seems like a dream to me. I still can't believe it's over. And she said, well, Mum, it doesn't seem like a dream to me anymore because there's no kidney machine, no shunts in my arms. She said, and also I can eat practically what I like now.
Nearly three decades later, in 1990, Joseph Murray won the Nobel Prize for his work. Within years, more and more people's lives were transformed by kidney transplants. Despite improvements in immune-suppressing drugs, patients had the best chance of success if the donated kidney came from a close relative or someone whose cell type closely matched theirs. The introduction of tissue typing and blood matching meant that fresh donor kidneys from accident victims could now be rushed to theatre for transplanting. This is from 1969.
Here in Cambridge, a young girl is being prepared to receive a new kidney, someone else's kidney. A man has died in a car crash. In death, his body can give life, provided that his kidney can be taken out within 1 hour of death. Despite all we hear about spare parts surgery, despite all the headlines, the transplanting of an organ from one body to another is still desperately risky. Yet the success rate is increasing year by year, until 70% of transplanted patients are alive 1 year after their operation.
This is the iliac artery which supplies the pelvis. It's been joined to the renal artery which supplies the kidney. You can see the row of stitches by my instrument. This is the ureter which drains urine into the bladder. You can see it under my finger at that point there. Nice kidney now. Looks pretty nice. Salmon pink.
But despite all the excitement, in the 1960s, transplantation and kidney dialysis to keep patients alive was still quite experimental. Doctors were still asking patients like Peter Rado to make some tough choices.
He came and sat on my bed and said, look, your kidneys won't keep you alive much longer, and you have a choice of two things. You could have a transplant, or I can offer you a place on my new dialysis unit. If you have a transplant, I'd recommend you go to Edinburgh, the best unit in the country at the time, where I think the mortality rate is 20% still alive after 2 years. And I looked a little bit aghast at that, and he said, alternatively, you could go on dialysis. And I said, what's the mortality rate there? And he said, we don't know. And he wasn't going to advise me, but he made it fairly obvious, I think, that dialysis was what I ought to do. And I did. And I'm not regretted that choice one bit.
The kidney machine is connected up to the patient's own circulation system so that his blood can be sent on the cleansing detour. But these patients are the lucky ones. Even if they do have to spend two nights a week, every week, for year after year in hospital, they are alive. The majority of patients with kidney failure don't even get the chance of life.
And effectively, it bought you time until such a time when transplantation had developed enough for you to be offered a kidney.
Yes, very much so, yeah. And I had an unsuccessful transplant in 86 and then a successful one in 88, which so far is still going. Touch wood, if I can find some.
As results with the kidney started to improve, surgeons turned their attention to other organs. The first attempts at transplanting the liver and the pancreas were made in the 1960s. And not to be outdone by these transplant pioneers, the heart surgeons began asking themselves whether transplanting an entire heart might be possible. Norman Shumway in the United States, speaking in 1976, recalls how the idea came to him in the 1950s.
In the animal laboratory, we would expose a heart for periods of an hour and a half, trying to find a better way to do open heart surgery. And we were wondering if there wasn't something further we could do with these animals. So it became clear after looking at the heart and various attitudes and postures that we could actually remove it and then suture it back in.
Well, I knew Dr. Shumway and I knew Dr. Dick Lauer, who had worked with him. They told me that they had worked out technically how to transplant a heart, and they were starting using the immunosuppression that I was using in the kidney. So I knew that all this background had occurred, and it was obvious that they were working up to doing this operation in man.
What Shumway didn't know at the time was that a young surgeon called Christian Barnard, who had visited Shumway's lab and seen firsthand their experimental heart transplant technique in animals, was getting ready to steal their thunder. And when the right donor came along, on the 3rd of December 1967, Barnard performed the world's first heart transplant on his patient Louis Washkansky at Groote Schuur Hospital in South Africa.
Here is the news, read by Colin Doran. A team of South African surgeons have successfully carried out the world's first operation to transplant a heart from one person to another. The operation began at 1 o'clock this morning.
I was standing at the operating table the first time and took out the heart of Louis Washkansky and looked into that empty chest. I have looked into many chests before, but the only difference was then that there was no heart inside that chest. And one felt... you would just like to turn around and look in somebody's eyes for some encouragement, for some sign that the result will be a success. And, of course, there was nobody that one could turn to.
How are you feeling now, Mr. Washkansky?
I'm feeling quite fine.
You're feeling well?
Feeling quite well.
What would you like to eat tonight?
Something light, you know.
Something like. How do you feel about it, being such a famous man now?
I told you I'm not famous. It's a doctor that's famous. It's the man with the golden hands.
The man with the golden hands.
That exclusive interview was conducted this afternoon by Dr. Bertie Bosman, one of the doctors responsible for Mr. Washkansky's welfare, with the kind permission of Professor Chris Barnard. As the doctors must be very careful that Mr. Washkansky is not infected, naturally, a normal interview with him was out of the question at this stage. Dr. Bosman agreed to talk with Mr. Washkansky on behalf of newsman Hannes Hubert, but that in itself was quite an undertaking. He had to hand the microphone and the cable which connects to the tape recorder to Sister Elizabeth de Villiers so that she could sterilize the equipment and take it to the ward. Meanwhile, Dr. Bosman was preparing himself in a similar fashion to the normal procedure for a doctor before he operates. While further down the passage, Hannes was waiting for the green light. When Dr. Bosman was ready, the ward sister summoned our newsman. Dr. Bosman handed the one end of the sterilized cable to him through the door of the ward, and he attached it to the tape recorder. And with Dr. Bosman's help, Mr. Washkansky's words went on tape.
Christian Barnard is an extremely handsome, outgoing film star kind of person who had enormous glamour as well as surgical expertise. He did pay compliments and respect to the work done by Shumway, but it was completely brushed aside by the media, who just wanted him to smile and hold hands with Gina Lollobrigida.
Christian Neathling Barnard,
associate professor of surgery at Cape Town University, the man who transplants human hearts, gets ready to meet the British press. 4.5 hours ago, he stepped off a flight from New York. Now, in a hotel room near London Airport, he prepares to talk once again about his work. Work that, in the space of a few weeks, has made him an internationally recognized figure. It will be his 19th press conference in 5 days. Everybody wants to talk to this man. The President of the United States invited him home for the day. The Mayor of New York gave him a reception. His own university, Cape Town, conferred its highest honor on him, a gold medal and the degree of Doctor of Science. The French sent him a life-sized human heart in solid gold. Since 5 o'clock on December the 3rd, when he completed the first human heart transplant operation in the history of medicine, life for the 46-year-old professor hasn't been the same.
Heart surgeons tend to be a bit different from the run-of-the-mill doctors. They tend to be very outgoing, and some of them are very aggressive. And they couldn't believe that this surgeon in South Africa had jumped the gun as far as they were concerned. So every heart surgeon who could transplant a heart technically, and they could all do that because it wasn't terribly difficult, most of them had a go at it without any interest or background in immunosuppression.
Holes in the science or not, transplanting the heart fired the public's imagination. This was the organ of love and life, perhaps even the seat of the soul. The media were all over the story, and the first patients. Despite Washkansky's death just 18 days after the operation, all over the world, cardiac patients couldn't wait for the chance of a new heart. And in 1968, over 100 patients got one. Even the cautious British jumped on the bandwagon. On the 3rd of May, the first British heart transplant was performed by a team led by surgeon Donald Ross. Naturally, Raymond Baxter ran the story the next day on Tomorrow's World.
This is the team that yesterday performed Britain's first human heart transplant operation. Here they are, all surgeons, physicians, anaesthetists, physiologists. The complete team whose skill, devotion and courage has already made British medical history. But first, at this moment, the object of all this attention, the patient is lying, as you will have heard, on the fifth floor of the National Heart Hospital in a sterile recovery room not 4 miles from these studios. He is Mr. Frederick West, a 45-year-old businessman. For the latest bulletin on his condition, we are going over to the National Heart Hospital now to hear from one of the doctors who is in that sterile recovery room within, I believe, a few feet of the patient. Doctor, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you very well.
This is Raymond Baxter in a television studio. How is the patient, Mr. West?
Well, he's doing extremely well at the present moment. He seems quite fit. He's just been talking to me about 5 minutes ago.
He's been talking to you?
Yes. He was asking after his wife and hoped I'd pass a message on if I managed to get the chance. I'm very glad to do so. He says he feels quite well.
In the flurry of excitement, the patient found himself in the full glare of the media spotlight.
How do you feel, Mr. West?
Oh, I feel fine. You know, I think I have a bit of a job keeping me tied in now because I want to get down to the next floor, and then the next floor. I think the nurses have a bit of a job.
You don't look as though you've been ill at all, if I might say so.
Well, it's hard to compare it between now and before. You know, I feel completely different.
Well, just how different do you feel with another man's heart inside
well,
you?
Well, I don't naturally feel the other heart, of course. You know, I could go out today kind of thing if it wasn't for them putting the chains on. And the nurses keeping me tied in bed all the time.
But 5 weeks later, the euphoria ended in tragedy. Fred West's wife.
He wasn't a guinea pig, really. He had no other chance because daily now he was having heart attacks. He'd already had the last rites 7 times, and he said he had another couple of times to go because he had almost 9 lives. No, he was glad to take the chance.
Do you feel, looking back, that it was worth taking that chance? Oh, yes. No, it was marvellous. He said it was worth it, right up to just before he took ill, you know. And of course, he didn't know much at all after that. He just became unconscious.
Almost all those patients died very quickly, and it did produce a very powerful groundswell of antagonism against heart transplantation, I think all transplantation, and against heart surgeons, and perhaps all surgeons, feeling that they were not really putting the patient's interest first, but more their own egos. And partly, I think it was due to the way in which the media had handled the Barnard case. But it was an unfortunate episode.
After the praise came the criticism. At first, it was no more than a murmur. Today, it can be heard round the world. Heart swapping is direct killing, Vatican. As well as secular and religious protests, there were those which came from medicine itself. Soon it became clear that the medical world was divided. In spite of further heart transplant operations in other parts of the world, that gulf grows wider each day.
An American professor has accused the transplant heart surgeons of practicing one-upmanship. Soviet specialists have considered the operation to be morally and ethically wrong.
Professor Barnard, in the medical press of Britain, some very distinguished people have been writing and expressing the view that operations for heart transplants, such as you have carried out, are premature and should not be done at this stage of surgical science. What is your comment on that?
I would like to answer your question by asking another question. Do these doctors believe that the fundamental research in cancer has been finished? And do they therefore object to cancer operations?
What is your reaction to the considerable amount of criticism that has been expressed over here? Do you feel there might be an element of jealousy in it?
No, sir. I feel that the highest trees always get the most wind.
But while Barnard was swaying in the breeze, many surgeons abandoned heart transplantation altogether. In the UK, the Department of Health recommended a moratorium. Donald Ross was one of the surgeons who did the first heart transplant in this country. Talking in 1977, he reflects on what happened.
The report from Chris Barnard of his first transplant really lit the flame and made us all keen to try and emulate what he'd done. Indeed, that's what we did.
What sort of chances did you give your patient at the time?
Absolutely unknown. But the patients themselves, they had no chance. So that anything theoretically was better than no chance.
Why did you agree with the recommendation from the Department of Health that these should be stopped for a while?
Well, you know, we decided to do three as a fair evaluation of the possibilities of heart transplantation. And we did that, and we ended up with the conclusion that really we didn't offer our patients much in the way of quality or quantity of life. We felt that it was right that somebody should carry on the work, and Dr. Schumer in America does so. So that I do agree with the decision not to go ahead with them on a routine basis in this country.
It's true that the very beginnings of heart transplantation were dismal, but we had the experimental success behind us, and our clinical results kept getting better all the time. So even though the American College of Cardiology at a meeting in San Francisco in 1970 said there should be a moratorium on heart transplantation, well, we listened to that, but obviously they weren't aware of the increasing better results that were coming from transplants. So during the 1970s, when everybody had stopped, we were fortunate to continue the program.
Away from the limelight, in California, this American surgeon, Norman Shumway, quietly worked away on the issue of tissue rejection. He realized that the real challenge was not the surgical techniques, but keeping the patient alive afterwards. Although immunosuppressive drugs had worked well for the kidney, they were far from perfect, and they needed to be adapted to suit the heart. His quiet perseverance slowly paid off. BBC Television's Tonight programme had this report in 1977.
It's the only hospital in the world where heart transplants are now routine. They do two a month, and there's over a 60% chance that the patients survive the first year, and it's improving all the time. The chances go down by about 10% a year, but one patient has already confounded the statistics by surviving for nearly eight. The surgeon who's achieved all this who's now done 133 heart transplants and has 54 of the patients still living, is Norman Shumway, the man who taught his transplant technique to Christian Barnard after experiments with animals 20 years ago.
A lot I do recall, a lot I don't. And as my life gradually wound down, I was well within the last week when they made the transplant, I recall very little of this, just sketches of it. The things that I do remember was they're going to have to do it quickly or it'll be too late. And I consider every day since my transplant as a bonus to my life. I have expressed it as being reborn, actually.
Shumway's success restored confidence in heart transplantation, and using his techniques, on the 14th of January 1979, a British team led by Sir Terence English at Papworth Hospital near Cambridge performed their first heart transplant on patient Charles McHugh. To everyone's great disappointment, Mr. McHugh died 2 weeks later, but the team was determined to push on with a second case. In August 1979, Keith Castle received his new heart.
And two men who've really got something to celebrate this Christmas are planning a little get-together today. They're Keith Castle and Andrew Barlow, who've both got new hearts thanks to the skill of the surgeons at Papworth Hospital near Cambridge. Keith Castle, the 50-year-old Londoner who had his heart transplant last August, is now out of hospital and leading a near-normal life. But he has to go to Papworth for some medical tests today. And while he's there, he's going to visit 29-year-old Andrew Barlow, who's still there recovering from his operation. We asked Mr. Castle what they'd be talking about.
Well, we've got our lung there, Paul. Between us two, at the minute, we're a club of two. So, obviously, we talk about hearts.
What difference has this operation made to your life?
It's just so marvellous. It's unbelievable. There's not one single word in the English language that can describe how I feel now. I must have lifted the jackpot of the year.
And this Christmas?
God, I never thought I'd see this one, and that's a fact.
The outlook for transplant patients continued to improve during the 1970s, but many of the key immunosuppressive drugs had serious side effects, particularly exposing patients to infections. So the search was on for new compounds with fewer side effects. The breakthrough came in 1977 when a Swiss scientist, Jean Borel, discovered a chemical made by a poisonous Norwegian fungus. It was called cyclosporin. It suppressed the immune system in a rather surprising way, as Borel himself explained in 1999.
Until then, all the agents and drugs which were immunosuppressive would also be anti-cancer drugs. That is, they were killing the cells, including those that caused rejection. But cyclosporin was not acting like that. It had a reversible effect. That is, it did not have any activity against cancer cells. Cancer would grow normally, but it would inhibit the reaction of the body against something which is foreign. And at the same time, it would not hurt the cells that fight infection. And this was extremely important.
Cyclosporin was so much better than anything else that it produced worldwide centres for transplantation of the kidney, the liver, heart and lungs, and pancreas for that matter.
Cyclosporin was approved for use in 1983, and while other drugs have been developed since, it remains one of the most popular immunosuppressive drugs used in transplantation today. But as demand for transplant operations grew, the supply of organs struggled to keep up. Many donor organs came from people who had died in road traffic accidents, and it was necessary to wait until the heart had stopped before any organs could be removed. But without a blood supply, organs would quickly degrade and they'd become useless for transplantation. As doctors were often unable to get permission from the next of kin to remove them in time, many potential donor organs were lost. During the 1960s, advances in critical care medicine led doctors to realise that machines to artificially support heart and lung function didn't actually preserve life. Once the patient's brain stopped working, recovery was impossible. And this meant that, theoretically at least, organs could be removed from brain-dead patients whose hearts were still beating and lungs still breathing, keeping the organ viable for transplant. But all this sparked confusion, and in the public's eyes, it blurred the previously clear line between life and death.
The governing fear in most of our minds is that it might be possible for an organ to be removed before a person is dead. But what is death? Father De Rosa.
I think all that we can have is a working definition of death, and we've got to take the judgment of a solid body of sound and prudent men, and where could you find on earth a more trustworthy profession than the doctors with a higher ethical code than theirs? We know when someone's bursting with life, we know when someone's as dead as a doornail because corruption has set in, but the dividing line between life and death, as we would expect, is fuzzy, and it may shift a bit from one generation to another. If we decide, you see, to give our organs, I think we've got to accept this slight uncertainty in regard to the moment of our own death. But for practical purposes, it makes no difference. You see, our condition is such that at this particular time, standard medical practice can't help us to live a meaningful life.
A new consensus was needed on how to diagnose death and when to turn these machines off so that organs could be ethically procured for transplant. The subject was hotly debated throughout the 1970s, and eventually a committee was set up to address the issue. Here's the Bishop of Stepney, interviewed in 1975 for the Today programme.
Well, I really want to see the law clarified so that there are no more doubts in the minds of doctors or others, the general public, concerning kidney transplant. And I want that done simply because we're in a situation in this country where there are so few kidney donors that hundreds of young people are dying because they cannot get a kidney. And there's no reason for this at all.
The committee says that when the brain has irreversibly stopped working, the patient is dead, even though the kidney, heart and liver may still be functioning. If a kidney is removed while the heart's still beating, then the chances of its being successfully transplanted are much greater. But I put it to Professor Roy Kahn, Professor of Surgery at Cambridge University, who's the committee's chairman, that a lot of people might be worried that an organ like a heart or a kidney might be removed before a patient was really dead.
I think there is this worry, and this is one of the purposes of our report, is to try and provide overwhelming safeguards so that this could never happen.
What safeguards?
Well, the safeguards are the methods of diagnosing death in the patient who has a brain that's destroyed, but whose heart is still beating and whose lungs are being ventilated by a machine.
Eventually, in 1976, a set of criteria for brainstem death was published. Organs could be preserved in the circulation of the brain-dead patient, while relatives decided whether or not they wanted their loved one's organs to be donated. Donor cards were also introduced to help boost supply, firstly in 1971 for the kidney, and then later to include other organs. Then we needed persuading to carry these cards.
Today's gathering at Regent's Park Zoo was of those lucky mothers who had found donors for a transplant. They'd all had healthy children after being set free from a kidney machine. The government's urgent plea is to persuade more people to carry donor cards. And the visible message was, none of today's happy children would have been alive were it not for some thoughtful donor.
I think we have to really accept the fact that the donor card is a failure.
That was Elizabeth Ward, who founded the donor card system after her son died of kidney disease while he was waiting for a donor organ. Speaking in 1994 on the BBC programme Public Eye, after numerous campaigns to publicise these cards, she describes how disappointed she was.
23 years ago, I actually imagined in my naivety that once everybody understood that there were then just over 1,200 patients on dialysis waiting for a chance to be returned to normal life, that everybody would carry a donor card. And how crazy I was, how wrong, do you know, after all these years, and it's sickening when you think of it, it's apathy and selfishness.
I obviously knew nothing about kidney machines or transplant situations or anything until we were in it ourselves, and once we were in it, the whole of life had stopped for us, really. He himself used to say, practically preface every remark by, after my transplant. He'd stopped living, he was waiting. And he was really just being kept alive, which is what everybody else is, waiting for a transplant. And why couldn't he have a transplant? Because most of these kidneys are sent down to crematoriums or buried 6 foot underground.
little has changed, and the gap between supply and demand continues to widen. It seems that it's not that we don't want to donate. Studies over the years have shown that most of us say we'd willingly hand over our organs after death. But few of us actually carry a card or join the NHS organ donor register. Many doctors in this country believe that the best way forward would be to presume consent rather than to ask for it. It's an idea that Roy Kahn has been talking about since transplantation began.
My own feeling is that a better way of dealing with this would be for anybody who did not want their organs used after death to register as an objector, to contract out, that is, and to have their names registered on a computer which would be always consulted by the hospital when somebody was brought in dead or who died suddenly, and so that if the wishes of this person or this family were against organ use after death, then they would obviously be respected.
In the UK, we still have to express our wish to donate or opt in. And meanwhile, the continuing organ shortage has created a rather more sinister market. In 1992, cadaveric organs were taken from executed Chinese prisoners, and the success of kidney transplants from unrelated live donors has raised the possibility of trading organs.
An investigation has begun into allegations that two Turkish peasants have been paid to donate their kidneys for transplant operations at a private London hospital. Bloomsbury Health Authority are carrying out the inquiry.
I think the sale of kidneys or anything of organs of the body is utterly repugnant. Utterly repugnant. And I think... Utterly repugnant. And I think that most... I think that most people would take that view. We are considering the position to see if legislation will be necessary.
Those discussions and concerns led to the Human Organ Transplant Act of 1989, making the buying or selling of organs illegal. But for one surgeon, Michael Buick, who was investigated in that case but allowed to continue to practice, the issues aren't quite as clear-cut as the law makes out.
I find it difficult to understand where recompense for giving a kidney begins and ends. It's acceptable to send, for the recipient, to send the donor a get-well card, or maybe a bunch of grapes, or what about a weekend in Paris, or the world cruise. Even today, those are technically acceptable. But if I gave him the £5, if the donor was given, say, the money rather than the cruise, that is unacceptable. If money passes hands, that doesn't worry me too much. What does worry me about money passing hands is the sort of middleman and the brokerage and the way that money can be subverted away from the donor.
Transplantation has come so far in such a short time. The microsurgical developments, the anti-immune drugs like cyclosporine, and even the ethical arguments. How much further can it go? In 1993, we had the first six-organ transplant.
5-year-old Laura Davies of Eccles in Greater Manchester has undergone a second multiple transplant operation at Pittsburgh Children's Hospital. She's received six new organs, replacing her stomach, her large intestine, her small intestine, her liver, her pancreas and her kidneys.
The amount of organs that can be transplanted doesn't seem to be limited by the immunology. In fact, it may be that transplanting more organs makes rejection less likely.
What are the organs that are proving particularly tricky?
Intestine alone has been very difficult, and also skin. Lungs are more difficult than most other organs. But it seems that when there is a composite graft, the difficult tissues seem to be accepted more easily. That's why this hand transplant is so important.
You've got quite a good grip now, haven't you?
Yes, just give me good attention.
That's quite a squeeze. That
yes,
is quite
is.
A remarkable squeeze, and the fingers are lovely and pink.
The hair growth on both my new hand and my arm are proceeding extremely well. I've cut the nails 3 times since the operation, so that shows another natural process that's proceeding.
And does it feel like your hand now?
It always has.
I met Clinton Hallam 6 years ago on the Radio 4 programme Case Notes. I'll never forget it. He was the world's first hand transplant patient. Since then, there have been more than 20 hand transplants around the world, and although Clinton's eventually failed, most of the recent ones are doing extremely well. and it seems the first face transplant to help those badly disfigured by disease or injury is also just around the corner. But what really excites transplant pioneers like Roy Kahn is the idea of growing replacement organs from our own cells, which will automatically be a perfect match. Then you wouldn't have to worry about anti-immune drugs at all.
If you could imagine taking a stem cell from, say, the blood of a person with kidney disease and treating it in such a way, probably requiring genetic manipulation and cloning, so that you could make an organ, a kidney, for that patient from his own tissues, that would be the ultimate answer to transplantation. It would be what we're all seeking, because you wouldn't need to give immunosuppressive drugs.
Growing your own organs from cells may be a long way off, but scientists have already tried transplanting cells to help cure disease, pancreatic cells to produce insulin in diabetics, or brain cells to treat Parkinson's disease. Another recent approach is to genetically manipulate a donor organ to disguise it so that the recipient's immune system doesn't recognise it as foreign. It's a technique that's being used in the groundbreaking field of xenotransplantation. Transplants from animals, mostly pigs, to humans. It's something Christian Barnard was dreaming about nearly 40 years ago, when he took the future of heart transplantation into his own hands and change the face of medicine forever.
Probably the pig may be a very suitable donor, as far as the anatomy is concerned, it's very closely related to man. And the other thing that's in favor of a pig as a donor is the fact that one can probably breed a pig more or less the same size as a human. We will, I hope in the future, have a method by which we will be able to suppress the body's reaction to, say, a pig heart.
The Archive Hour was presented by Graham Easton, and the programme was produced by Beth Eastwood. After the news, part two of the classic serial, The Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens, starring Timothy Spall and Sue Johnston. And as this one is entitled Too Full of Adventure to be Briefly Described, well, you'll just have to sit tight and listen in full. And while we're on the subject of classics...
Drama this Christmas on BBC Radio 4.
Oh, Lorna Doone! Lorna Doone is the lovely maiden who has stolen poor somebody's heart.
Timothy West stars in a tale of love and vengeance.
One of the great rough men caught her up in his arms and kissed her. And if I had only brought my gun, I would have shot him.
Lorna Doone. Monday to Friday at 10:45 in the morning and again at 7:45 in the evening.
BBC Radio 4.